What's up, y'all? Welcome to the Sports Medicine Broadcast. The athletic trainer as a social worker. This week, our guests are Lucas Dargo, currently a doctorate of athletic trainer student up in, I want to say Indiana University. Is that right, Lucas?
Yep, Indiana State University.
Indiana State, okay. Yeah, see, all that's foreign country to me. I'm just from Texas, so.
I understand. It's all good.
And we have Don Tedrow. Don is a licensed clinical social worker. Licensed clinical social worker. There you go. Sorry about that.
Correct.
Those initials messed me up, and then I just got all mixed up in my head. Without much further ado, I'm your host, Jeremy Jackson. I have my faithful companion here, Sean Reedy. Sean has been doing lots of great work on the Sports Medicine Broadcast and getting some rodeo sports medicine interviews, so we're going to be looking forward to those. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/social work. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/social work. Whenever you want to check out the links, I'll have a link to their PowerPoint. So Don and Lucas are going to kind of talk to us about why an athletic trainer needs to understand and be competent and confident in being a case reporter or social reporter, our mandated reporter for social work, CPS, and how this issue came about and how they began working together. So again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/social worker. Again, social worker. I think it said social work earlier. Lucas, I know you shared your story on the listener spotlight, but why don't you tell us just a real quick overview of your athletic trainer story?
Sure. Well, I'm currently a doctoral student at Indiana State University in their doctorate in athletic training program, and I am working with ATI Physical Therapy, and I'm a contractor to Eli Lilly and Company. So I'm working in the occupational health setting currently, but for the past 3 years, I worked in the high school setting, the two past being with Mrs. Tedrow.
All right, and that's a perfect intro. Don, why don't you give us your story? Obviously not athletic trainer story, but how'd you get to where you are?
I became interested in social work probably about 15, 20 years ago. I knew I wanted to get into a therapy role and finally landed on clinical social work. And I really enjoy working with the student population, that age group. Being with Youth First allows me to actually be inside the schools every day, all day long, to work with them and help them develop coping skills and work out some issues that they may be having.
All right. So you're not a school counselor. You're a social worker working with Youth First, but
correct.
But full-time inside of one high school?
Yes. Yes. I am currently located in a high school in Evansville, Indiana. I previously worked with Lucas Dargo at a different high school, but I really enjoy it. And I'm glad that we have the social workers there in the school.
All right. So is that relatively common? I don't know for sure if we have a social worker here on our campus, but I don't think we do.
Okay. You know, there are many schools that don't have a social worker in their school. I actually didn't hear about it until probably about 10 years ago. And I just kind of stumbled into sharing an office with the school social worker, observed the work that she was doing with the students, and just fell in love with it and knew that I wanted to be involved with Youth First. Here in Indiana, where we live, Youth First works in southern Indiana. I know I'm going to get this wrong. I believe that we have about 35 to 40 social workers spread out between elementary schools, junior highs, and high schools. Roughly about 40 or 42 of them, of the schools, have a social worker. So some of them have multiple schools that they go to every day.
I gotcha. All right. Well, Lucas, why don't you start us off? We're going to go through the presentation you guys have prepared, and then Sean and I will have questions as we go through. All right. So, Lucas, take us away.
Absolutely. Well, we originally came up with this idea because Don Tedrow and I were working together, and we kind of noticed that we didn't really know exactly what each other's roles were, to be real honest at first. And so we had to really do a lot of self-introduction of not just ourselves, but really what our profession did. I'll tell you a little bit about my background, and then we'll kind of get in a little bit more about why we want to talk about this. So my background, I graduated in 2013 from Ball State University, and then I was there for 5 years because I was athletic trainer and health education major. I went to Ohio University, where I graduated in 2014. And like I said earlier, I'm currently working on my doctorate in athletic training at Indiana State University. So hopefully I'll graduate next year. And that's a little bit about my background. So Mrs. Tedrow, do you want to talk about your background just briefly?
Well, you know, like I said, I'm the youth first social worker in the high school. I graduated with a Bachelor of Science in Psychology at USI, went on to get my master's in clinical social work at USI, and then later earned my licensed clinical social worker, my LCSW. And I knew right away I wanted to be in the schools.
So after we kind of met each other the first couple of weeks of working at the high school together. And what brought this up was that we actually had a case. So we kind of stumbled upon this particular case where we had a runner. I noticed this, I want to say it was about a week before it was sectionals. And we noticed that we had one girl in particular, this was for track, that she was running before school, and then after practice, she was also running, and we weren't really sure what was going on at first. And so I also was working with her, and she had some chronic injuries. And so we know in track that that's not uncommon to have the chronic injury, but after we're trying to work with her and trying to figure out, you know, how we could get her to taper down a little bit before we went into our sectionals. And so then that's when we started to notice that there might be some kind of abuse going on. So our athletic director was the one that actually brought it up to me, because we had a very perceptive, wonderful athletic director. And then after some conversations of maybe what was going on, we found out that her parent, her dad, was actually having her wear this fitness watch where it tracked where and how quickly she went. So he was logging her miles because he thought that that was the way that she was going to be able to excel in running, was, you know, by continually running and getting a lot of miles on it. And so really this came down to, we, Don and I worked together with our athletic director and this athlete and her parents. And we really had to get this taken care of. And that was kind of where this journey of us having this conversation about what does it mean for athletic trainers to be mandated reporters, where Mrs. Tedrow, where she works in the high school setting, I was, I taught health. So I only saw a certain amount of students each day. She was able to have a lot more insight during the day of what maybe our athletes were going through on a day-to-day basis. And so really we want to establish a good rapport with either our school counselor or our social worker at the school, along with the athletic trainer. So this could be, whether it be at the middle school, junior high, or the high school level, we really want to talk about collaboration and interprofessional collaboration and the key to that. So that's where I think, Don, you have some information where you wanted to present on why is there a need, and really where do we need to be looking? And I'll also discuss a little bit of about what can athletic trainers do to look for these signs of abuse, and really what should we do, and what are ways that we can collaborate to really try to help someone once we realize that there might be an abuse case going on. So Ms. Tedrow, do you want to talk a bit?
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So some of the things that Mr. Dargo and I have worked on is he would pay attention to the athletes that he saw on a daily basis and the students that were in his office. So he got to know them. And one of the things that we like to watch for is behavior that's out of character for the student. Now, everybody has their good days, has their bad days. This is something that is just out of the norm for this individual that maybe carries on for 2, 3, 4 days. And, you know, you just kind of, maybe it wouldn't hurt to ask what is going on. I think at some point, Mr. Dargo had students doing some journaling or some exercises in class, and he would see that students talked about some of the things that stressed them out that were going on at home or at school or with a boyfriend or girlfriend or just their peers. And maybe they just needed somebody to talk to. And then there were the more serious cases, of course, you know, where a student was suffering from things like depression, anxiety, and it helps to have the social worker in the school so that we can meet with that student one-on-one on a weekly basis or more if needed and work on those skills to help them cope with that. Just like he was talking about the student that was running, I'm a mandated reporter in the school, and I believe at the school that we worked at here in Indiana, everyone that was employed at the school is a mandated reporter. So if I happen to not be there for some reason, then he would have to get in touch with somebody to make that report. And that's when we decided that, you know, how many people out there know what to watch for. There's certain injuries that he sees that they're just strange injuries. I mean, I don't know what to look for as far as the injuries, but he does. He's trained in that. If a student is cutting, why are they cutting? If they're having suicidal thoughts, maybe posting things on Facebook, lots of various reasons for the students to be struggling. And it was easy for me to be able to pull them in and say, look, you know, people are concerned about you. What's going on?
All right. Okay. Sean, you used to work at Rice University. It's a very prestigious academic school. You had a lot of athletes that were, you know, on scholarship, and it's like $50,000 a year to go to Rice. So if they aren't performing academically, then there's probably a lot of stress. Did you have any situations where you felt like you needed to refer somebody to counseling for
daily? The funny thing is coming from Rice, obviously you see these student athletes that are in that position or potentially I guess some would think they shouldn't be as stressed. They come from a better background. They come from potentially more money. They are a Division I athlete. They probably have a very good, let's just say, success. They know how to succeed. But that's the crazy thing is, there was a potential in probably every one of our athletes, just due to the amount of stress load that they do have with their classes. You've got potential for trying to get a scholarship, those that are possibly walk-ons or something like that. You've got those that are dealing, just like you guys both said, dealing with the boyfriend issues, the girlfriend issues, dealing with the at-home issues, the parents are pushing me, parents want me to do this, you know, I really don't really even want to play football anymore, or I don't even want to play sports anymore. And then you're getting the pushback from the education side of things, because that was obviously a huge educational institution, and where a lot of the teachers, the faculty, don't understand athletics and or don't understand, well, no matter why you couldn't or why you didn't have the time to put in maybe what they expected that you needed to be putting in, when you're in the middle of season, or not giving you the time to the awareness early enough to be able to prepare for something. So I guess the long for sure answer of that is absolutely. And we would run into that in everything. And I mean, it's everything though that I would see at the junior college setting that I've seen in other college settings. You run into, like I said, family issues, you run into boyfriend, girlfriend issues, you run into drug issues, you run into, I have to make money for my family, so I'm going to do things that are probably illegal. And I've had, I can't even count the amount of sit down and talk sessions with countless athletes in my career, but especially at Rice.
All right, Lucas, why don't you tell us a little bit more about your athlete? You said that they were logging their miles and you felt like there was some pressure from the parent. So what are some of the other things that you noticed that made you send that athlete to Don?
Well, so just noticing that there was kind of like a sharp change in mood. And that's something that I think athletic trainers, we do a very good job of being able to identify when one of our athletes is having an off day. And like Don said, is that we all have off days, and there's a difference between a one day, today wasn't so great. But just slowly seeing a decline in her demeanor and how she was kind of presenting herself, and wasn't as happy-go-lucky as she typically was. So those are one of the things that I was looking for. And also, like I mentioned earlier, where you're seeing injuries. I kept seeing these long-term injuries where she was just continually having increased pain, and everything that we were doing just seemed like it wasn't working. And that's where I think as an athletic trainer, we need to evaluate. And I know we do, but sometimes when we reevaluate, we're not reevaluating because this might be something that the student athlete is doing outside of our athletic training clinic, or they're doing outside of athletics. A lot of times we take it on ourselves. Maybe we're not picking the right modality. Maybe we're not using the right treatment protocol. And so I think that's where I started to also notice that we really need to have a sit down conversation, and we needed to start collaborating. And so really, I think that after this instance, it started to really occur to me that I think that there's a lot more warning signs out there. And if we reflect on, as an athletic trainer, how many times we're there to allow our student athlete to vent. You know, we're not just treating their physical well-being, but we're also there to help, with their mental well-being. So that's why, I think Don and I think being able to have that good communication with each other, because we know that if the athletic trainer is identifying this particular stress, that there might be ways that you can work with other people in the school to really help this student athlete, and being able to and try to have a multi-prong approach. And this is where, like we were talking about, where in this particular case, the parent was the one that was driving this particular conversation, but not always, right? So we have to make sure that we're always keeping the parents or the guardians involved in this communication when appropriate. And I think that's where it's so critical to have someone like Don Tedro, where she understands that a little bit better, where when we're coming out of our schooling, we're not always sure of what to do when we see these kind of cases. And something else I wanted to bring up is we want to talk about, what do we do if we see a coach that's maybe being abusive or doing something like that? So Don, did you want to talk about that for a few moments and really your experience with that maybe?
Well, whenever we were researching for this presentation, this podcast, we ran across some journals where they talked about where incidents where it wasn't necessarily the parent that was abusing the student, but the coach that was. And several where the coach would take the opportunity to develop maybe an inappropriate relationship with the student. They would begin priming them so that they were the individual that this person came to. And over time, it would lead to very inappropriate things happening between them, maybe a relationship that shouldn't be occurring. Other things were that we came across, coaches that would use like emotional abuse to try to encourage the student to perform better. So push themselves. So perhaps they would start, calling the student names, belittling them, making it a point to let them know you're not going to play in the game because, you're not working up to par, but not in a healthy manner. This was specifically stated in a way to make this person feel very, very bad about themselves. And I would become particularly concerned about students who, when they would come in after they lost, like, during track or something, my dad's going to be upset, my mom's going to be upset, or my coach is going to be upset. That bothers me. Now, it doesn't always necessarily mean that there is abuse going on. It could be something going on with the student, but we still have to take a good look at that to try to determine what's the issue here. And a lot of times whenever the students are in this abusive relationship with the coach or a parent, they don't realize it. They are so far immersed into this relationship with this individual, and they start doing a lot of negative self-talk, saying negative, bad things to themselves, you're no good, getting depressed and just falling deeper and deeper into this pit, that, by the time we do realize something's going on and they're able to take a step back and really look at it and analyze it, they had no idea it was even happening to them. So you would think it would be so much easier if the student could come to us and say, my coach is abusing me or my parents are abusing me. Sometimes they can't see it. They're too close.
Absolutely. And that's where we have to be in there to be able to recognize that and to be able to be their advocates.
Something that I think that I've seen a lot is that you really need to, not only when it comes to an injury, so you're talking about a potential stress fracture or something like that from overtraining or something of that sort, but also honestly just having that relationship and knowing your athletes, because we're with them so often. We're with them, you know, during August camp, 12 hours a day some days, and or during, at other times we're traveling with them. We're kind of the place where they will blow off steam as they come in and they start talking in the athletic training room, because everyone knows that in the athletic training room or athletic training clinic, that's where everybody talks and that's where information comes out. It's kind of one of those things too, where you have to know your patient, know your athlete in just somewhat of a personal level, because you'll know that, hey, they're not acting like themselves. When you have that concussed athlete that comes off the sideline, you know your patient, you know your athlete, so now I know, hey, they're not acting like themselves. But the same thing when they're stressed or they're being abused or they're having something going on, their girlfriend is pregnant, they're in a money crisis, they don't have enough money to continue to go to school, aren't eating, they're living in their car. All of these real scenarios that I've actually dealt with. So something, knowing your athlete and being able to just kind of catch on those little things, correct?
Oh, absolutely. And I think that that's where so often in our high school athletic training clinics and even in the junior high, where we're so busy and we're so fast paced, right? And sometimes we're not allowing ourselves to catch that. So that's where just being more perceptive, I think that's really where it's coming from. And being aware of these issues, I think that's the biggest battle we need to, you know, fight continually, is to be able to say, yes, I know that I need to be able to get this student athlete out to football practice or to, you know, whatever practice they happen to go to, but also be able to just find that way. And we all, I think, have our own unique, special way that we're able to connect with our patients. So really being able to draw on what you already do, but just to have a little bit more sense about it and to be able to be a little bit more pragmatic, I think.
One of the other things, like, I look at with you two and what you've done, and obviously talking how you created this and how you came about this for that one athlete, for sure, was the relationship that you guys had. Because in sometimes other settings, not being in the same district, not being in the same, or potentially being on two opposite sides of campus in the college setting, if I refer someone for counseling, or that potentially needs help or needs something because they are having an issue, sometimes I lose it. I lose track of everything, or I lose track of that athlete. One, because obviously we're so busy and you've got a million things going on and there's so many things that you're trying to keep up with. But two, you kind of sometimes fall into that issue of where I'm only trying to help the athlete, but then you're not getting shared information, and you're not, where I'm not saying I want to know everything and know all the information and know what's going on with them as long as they're safe, but I want to be able to know that they're safe, and I want to be able to talk with that counselor or psychologist, psychiatrist, whatever that we're dealing with at the time, and be able to know that that athlete is safe and that they're in a better place, and that technically I can allow them to compete and I can allow them to play, because a lot of times that's one of the biggest things that they have going for them. I guess, so off of that, what would be recommendations from you guys to help that relationship? How do I, besides seeking that out before I need it, which is obviously always a good direction or good way to do things, but how would you recommend working with these people or trying to create a relationship so that when my athletes need that assistance, I can go about it in a correct manner?
Do you want me to speak to this? Okay. All right. So the system that Mr. Dargo and I had in place, you know, he was very good about seeking me out when he first started working there, finding out what it is that my job is. And I think the most important thing for any athletic trainer is where you are employed, look at the policy and find out who is the mandated reporter. You may not ever need this information, but it's good to know just to kind of have that information in your back pocket. So who is a mandated reporter? Well, a mandated reporter is somebody who's required by law to report any suspected child abuse. So generally speaking, this is anyone working in the following settings like social services, education, childcare, law enforcement, and medical personnel. And it varies from state to state. And so that's why it's really important for you to seek out that information. Where we work together here in Indiana, it was nice that when Lucas Dargo would find a student that he was concerned about, sometimes it was hard to get in my office because, you know, the door was always shut talking to a student, but he had my cell phone number and he could text me or call me anytime. And there were times when, you know, I wanted him to make sure you can get a hold of me anytime you want. Maybe he didn't have time until after work and he would just shoot me a text message. Can I call you real quick and call me just to run by me? This is what I'm seeing with this student. And I mean, I always followed up with these students, and it also helped for Lucas to be able to tell the student, hey, you know, I know the social worker, and I know it's kind of scary that she has social worker in her title, but she's really a therapist. And would you mind going and talking to her? And so they always would, because they respect Mr. Dargo. And a thing that you also have to be aware of is that when students come to me, all the information is confidential information. And so, you know, I would check back with him and let him know, you know, whether there was something that he needed to be concerned about. I would always follow up, but I can't go into detail about what is going on with that student without that student's permission. Now, while I was looking through the research, I saw that where some people may feel like because they have to report perhaps the coach or something, that it would cause a rift between them and their employer. And so it is also a good idea to have somebody on the side who can be that mandated reporter for you. So it doesn't necessarily have to come. It could be made anonymously. So it could be maybe a psychologist that, you know, you pay a little bit of money to make this call for you, or maybe a friend that could make the call in a confidential manner. But my experience has been anytime I have called the child abuse hotline, I always have the option to report, to make an anonymous phone call. But sometimes people are put off by that and worried that this is information that could come back and jeopardize their job. So it's nice to have a little backup plan just in case.
Absolutely. And I think that's where really just having a protocol, that's I think our biggest idea of our conversation is knowing that it's important to have a plan in place, just like how we have heat illness protocols or concussion protocol. This is absolutely essential because we know, just like we've already mentioned, all of these different stressors, whether it be the injury itself causing the thoughts, the negative self-thoughts, and everything else. It's so important to be able to have that collaboration.
I think that obviously at a collegiate setting, you're not dealing with a under 18-year-old child. And one difficulty that I would sometimes run into was I would talk to that student athlete, and this is at different institutions, would talk to a student athlete, have a recommendation there, and try and have them go and, hey, let's consider talking to a counselor. Let's consider talking to someone about this. And then it was kind of one of those issues where you run into the fact of you basically get shut out of everything from there on. And the athlete potentially has signed a waiver saying, Sean can know everything. Sean's the reason I'm here. Sean's the only reason that I am trying to get help for this. And it was kind of one of those where you're trying to deal with so many different things and you're trying to really only help the athlete, and then kind of doors get shut on you. So I guess that's kind of my follow-up to that is what's your recommendations, and how do you, I guess, address that, and how do you try and make sure that your athlete is in a or your student or whomever even you're looking at is taken care of and at least keeping somewhat in the loop without obviously getting divulged information that they potentially don't want divulged to you?
Well, on my end, I think communication is really the most important thing. And even though I'm now at a new school, I'm already developing that relationship with like the athletic directors and the coaches there as well. And I've had them come to me concerned about a student, and I try to follow up with them, you know, even though I can't give them details, still keep them in the loop a little bit so that they know what's going on. And if you feel like you're, you know, you'd like to know a little bit more information, it doesn't hurt to ask. You know, sometimes I just assume, well, they've passed it off to me, so, you know, it's, you know, somebody's taking care of it. You know, not that you don't care about your student, but, you know, you're busy and you've got things to do. And so I don't think that it's intentionally done, but I'm sure it is. So, oh, yeah, always ask and try to stay involved. I don't know if you can speak on this as well, Lucas.
Yeah, I really think that the most important aspect of this is being able to communicate as much as you can to the coaches and to the athletic trainer, anyone that really is surrounding the athlete, but while still making sure that the athlete feels as though they're able to safely speak to whoever, you know, they have been speaking to, because you don't want to cut off that communication. So I think there's just such a fine line, and that's where we have to really, I think, experience is the biggest teacher here, where we learn what we really need to do when, but also that's where bouncing off ideas with those that are more experienced, because oftentimes that's what I had to do, was, you know, just to talk it out and really have that closed door conversation of, this is what I think is going on, but, you know, I'm not really sure. And just being able to look at that specific case, and then Don would, you know, say, well, have you asked this, or have you done this? And, oftentimes, no, I hadn't done that. So I think we all have those individuals that we work with that have a great deal of experience in a certain area, and really just being able to figure out who is the best resource for that, and then being able to escalate things as needed.
Lucas, you mentioned you guys have a protocol like we do for EAP or whatever. As far as I know, we don't have something like that. Can you talk a little bit more about what yours is?
Well, absolutely. Well, that's something, honestly, as we were getting into our second year together, that's where we had a lot of conversation about it, but we did not have something in writing. And that's where, if we were going to be together, life kind of changed courses on that. So we never actually got something in writing, but that's where I'm encouraging you, all that's listening, that what it should look like should be, who do you contact? What are the basically what starts off this conversation, and where does it lead? You know, I think just like any of our other protocols, I think it's really a good idea to have legal advice with this, and to have a legal sign off on it, and make sure that what you are doing is legally sound, and it's something that everyone can buy into. And I think having a collaborative approach, so that's where just having that conversation with our athletic director and with Don, I think that by the two of us starting to get that ball rolling, I think that the next logical step would have been for us to bring into our coaches and have at our coaches meeting. And then also talking with our school administrators outside of athletics, and really getting this approved by the school board. And so where I was in terms of all the other protocols that I've working with, we were trying to update them, and we sent those to the school board and actually had those approved, and making sure that once again, we had the legal authority and making sure that we were kind of covering all of our bases. So that's where I think this is going to look maybe a little different depending on your area and depending on your resources. We were very lucky to have a youth first social worker at our school, but not all schools have that. So what it would look like at one high school could look very different in another area, but with the same intent of making sure that we're not just taking care of the immediate need, but also making sure that there's follow-up, and we know who is supposed to report, and when is that called, you know, needed?
All right. In the PowerPoint, in the slideshow here, again, that can be found at sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/social worker. You guys have what is considered possible abuse. So why don't y'all discuss those real quick?
Okay. So the first one is physical abuse, which would, what we normally see as the obvious forms of abuse, which is suspicious bruises, sprains, or breaks. The student may attempt to hide the injury, or you see that it's, you've seen it, but it just keeps happening, and you're getting stories like, you know, it just hasn't healed right, or I fell down. Things that just don't look right. Emotional abuse is another one that people sometimes don't think about. And just like we talked about with the suspected abuse from like maybe a coach or a parent, that is the excessive yelling, name calling, put downs, or belittling the individual. And this can result in psychological problems like depression, post-traumatic stress disorder, and anxiety. The third one is neglect. And this is one that I have talked to a lot of people at the high schools that I work at. This could be a failure to care for basic needs of the individual, not providing necessary medical care, including therapist or getting their medication, clothing, or food. If you have a student who's maybe not getting enough rest and it's just happening time and time again, and you find out, well, we were evicted from our house and, you know, we've been sleeping in our car. Mom, you know, can go take us to, you know, the shelter, but she chooses not to. That's a neglectful situation. If they've been referred by a physician to take medication that they do need, that's neglect. If they've been referred to speak to a guidance, to a counselor about things that are going on, and let's say the student is depressed and has had some suicidal ideation and the parents refuse to take them, then that is also neglect. So whenever we were talking about if your school does not have, or your employer does not have a policy put in place, I stumbled across some examples of bans and key definitions. And these can be used to be placed into your policy so that there's specific guidelines to follow. And an example would be like the physical abuse. And the key definition for that would be contact or no contact, conduct that results in or reasonably threatens to cause physical harm to an athlete or other sports participants. Physical abuse is also any act or conduct described as physical abuse or misconduct under federal or state law. These can be found if you would like to look at them and possibly insert them into your policy. They're going to be present, I guess, after the podcast is done.
Yes.
So, and so these are guidelines specific that give you key definitions for the physical abuse, the emotional abuse, and the neglect, so that you can read it and specifically see what's the pattern that I'm looking for. When do I need to make this call? And another thing that I wanted to touch on, even though the athlete that you may be working with is 18 or older, we can still get adult protective services involved. So don't hesitate to make the phone call to the child abuse hotline. And if they feel like that this is something that's out of their realm of expertise, they can refer you to who this needs to be reported to. A lot of information.
I've had two girls come to me who were cutting, you know, as an athletic trainer, like, hey, can you cover this up for me? And I was like, look, you know that I have to tell somebody. You're like, please don't. I was like, look, I understand that you don't want anybody to know, but I have to tell the counselor. I have to. It's my job. Right. And I care about you. And so, you know, I end up telling the counselor. And then from there, like you said, I don't feel like there was any follow-up unless I went and asked about it. Yeah. But I don't know that I've had that. Maybe it's just I'm not perceptive enough and I need to have some more examples or some more case studies, that kind of thing, things to think about, look through, or watch. But I think we all have experienced it once we've been in here for just a little while, like Sean was talking about people who are living in their car, but we just have to be prepared. So some of the things that we might be looking for are some of the things you've already mentioned, but do you have any other, maybe Lucas, you got any other stories, any other real life practical examples where you guys work together on a case?
Yeah, I think one of my examples, and this wasn't actually with a student athlete, it was with an athletic training student where he was going through a breakup, and I was just, you know, I was actually seeing his demeanor just change, and once again going back to cutting and seeing that there were signs of him doing that to himself. So I think watching, are they covering themselves more than usual? Is it super hot out? And then they have a lot of excuses. And I think that's what it comes back to, just like what you said, Jeremy, is that every case is so specific. And I think that they're there. Oftentimes we just don't have that that connection for whatever reason. So I think just being more perceptive and really looking at the literature that we presented and even diving past this and being able to, when things aren't adding up, I think that's my biggest takeaway, is that when they don't have, there's not a good excuse for that injury to continue. They're, for whatever reason, they're continuing to have that chronic long-term injury or those unexplained bruises.
Okay, so we were originally intending to have Shelly join us, and she just got onto the call a little bit late, obviously, but she just said she had some drama. So, Shelly, why don't you say hello real quick?
Hi. Hi, everyone.
Hi, Shelly.
All right, so Shelly's currently at LSU. She is one of the senior athletic trainers for football and currently pursuing her master's in the licensed social, the LCSW. Whatever I said it was at the beginning. Yes. What is that again?
Licensed clinical social worker.
There you go. Licensed. I keep thinking school because I'm in a school. But licensed clinical.
Yes, I'm in school.
Social worker. So, all right, Shelly, what we're currently kind of doing is walking through some physical examples. So Lucas talked about some of his examples that he's had. Sean's talked about his. Sean Reedy, formerly of Rice University. Can you give us some examples of how you've dealt with social work or CPS reporting type issues?
Well, I think the nature of athletic training is actually morphed itself over time into what is essentially a social work issue, right? So we're dealing with student athletes that are coming from, you know, I'm from Louisiana. So we are 49 or 50 in every category pretty much. So we're dealing with lots of poverty and lots of violence and separation from parents. And so by default, when they come here, it's, you know, it would be easy for me to turn a blind eye to the obvious, but I never have done that. I've always kind of, you know, put my foot in my mouth where it doesn't belong. And from that has come, you know, this interest in really giving the athletes something more than just my athletic training skills, and making it more legal, because, you know, while we know as athletic trainers, we can do these jobs, the best thing for us to do is to refer, because we're not specialists in that area. And I really wanted to become more proficient in the area of counseling, because I feel like that's one of my strengths.
Yeah, that's what we were just discussing, is that I'm not very perceptive to people's emotions. One of the things I learned way back when I first started teaching was to greet the students at the door, because then you have a better chance of seeing their face, seeing their emotional state as they're walking into your class that day. And I've done that pretty much the whole time I've been teaching, is if at all possible, I greet the kids at the door, say hello, and I'll maybe make them jump and give me a high five or whatever it is.
Right.
But it gives them a positive interaction and also get to see how they are that day. So,
right. And that's, as athletic trainers, obviously, you know, the equivalent would be as soon as they take their sock off, you know, and the ankle's there in your face. They're stuck there, and they're not moving for as long as I want to tape them. And, you know, if you feel it's not right, it's probably not right. And so it's so easy, you know, just in the regular population to walk by people without making eye contact and just, you know, busting out your phone. And so as athletic trainers, we really, you know, you shouldn't be doing that. You should be engaging with your student athletes. And so it's been really an easy and obvious transition. I intended still to do both, because I do feel like there's still stigma associated with the counseling aspect of things. And student athletes are going to have a hard time probably leaving the athletic training room setting and going to, you know, this mystery building with someone that's wearing a, you know, coat or a tie and thinking for one second that they would possibly understand, even though as a social, you know, as a potential social worker, future social worker, I understand that these things are easy for us to understand. The problems are the problems, whether they're coming from an athlete or coming from the regular population. But the perception for student athletes is that they have a pretty unique life, and they do, you know, especially at a D1 level school. And so doing it from the training room, you know, not to say that I'm not going to have my own room, but this is a safe environment. And ultimately what we're trying to do is create safe environments for them to be able to communicate what's going on emotionally with them. So trying to incorporate the two together is, I've learned, is extremely unique. I think there's only a handful, if any, in the country. So it'll be some challenges that are associated with it, but it's, you know, it's one of those things that's just critical. You can't turn your blind eye to it anymore.
So Shelley, that was kind of one thing that I had touched on a little bit was, you know, in our setting, or my previous setting, and in the college football setting, or in the Division I level setting, you're not as much dealing with the abuse, the child abuse, or the potential abuse from a parent. Sometimes, yes, you do get the abuse down from a coach a little bit, but more so dealing with those life issues, those things that they're dealing with alongside of trying to keep their scholarship up. Things with trying to keep their child that they are potentially going to have, the ability to survive, the ability to eat, those stresses where I've had plenty of sit downs, or even that senior that comes in as a potential NFL prospect or Major League Baseball prospect or something like that, and has now had no junior season, comes into their senior season and is hit with no junior season because of injury, and now is hit with an injury in their senior season and basically no longer have the possibility for a NFL or Major League Baseball career or something like that.
Yeah.
So right. That's kind of the questions that I had and I have is how do those things in that setting or our setting, one that I'm more comfortable with, affect as well outside of just the abuse? Because I've gotten that text message or staff or people that I know have gotten that text message of, hey, have you ever considered killing yourself, or have you can just tell that the depression and whatnot has just drained them so much.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry if you see me moving around. Am I just by voice right now? So I'm looking for a plug before I lose y'all.
All right, Don, can you kind of discuss that answer while Shelly's kind of looking for a way to
connect? I sure can. And that's one of the things that we discuss a lot with the students in the classroom in the high schools and the junior high schools. The first thing that we want to make sure that we do is acknowledge that, you know, there's something going on with this student. Question them. And a lot of people feel uncomfortable with doing that, but do it in a way of, hey, you know, I noticed that you're really stressed out. You're going through a rough time right now. And sometimes whenever people are really stressed out, they start to have thoughts that they want to end their life. Are you having these kind of thoughts? And usually you'll get this reaction, like the stunned look, like, how did you know? Another thing is persuade the student to get the help that they need, and then refer them to that individual. And that's my hope, that, you know, with you being the athletic trainer, that they feel so, that bond with you, especially during that moment that they're having these suicidal thoughts, that they're going to go along with what you say. And sometimes I've had a favorite teacher or a coach or the athletic director come with the student. We want them to feel comfortable. We want them to feel like they are protected at that time. And just to make sure that they get the help that they need. Absolutely.
So I'm back. I've got you again. Thank you for filling in there.
Oh, absolutely.
So I'm trying to think back to your question, but the one word that popped in my head was resilience. And so, you know, you've got a scenario where you think these athletes are resilient, and they are in so many different ways. But at the end of the day, they're just another kid in the population with all these troubles, you know, and tribulations that they deal with at home. When you sprinkle on academics, which for some of them is not something that comes easy, and then the coach is yelling on top of them, that's kind of the catalyst for the end point. So for the athletic trainer to be there to see it happen, is what's really for me been amazing, because I can anticipate, and I think honestly part of this is that I'm a female, so it might be the mom, you know, mom in me that picks up on that. But I see the yelling and I think of myself, well, that's not going to go well, because that coach does not know what that kid's been dealing with this whole week. So what I could do then is walk up to the kid after practice. So, you know, my hope is that by having maybe a social worker in this setting directly like this, that I can, you know, you're more proactive. You can preempt the situation. And then I've got the relationship. So it would not be unusual for me to say, you know, suicide is something that a lot of college kids think about. I see you're struggling here. You know, is it possible that you're thinking about that? And they'll, because of the relationship that's developed, they'll say right away, yeah, kind of embarrassed by that, but yeah. And so it gets neutralized, less stigmatized. We can again talk about medicines that are going to be used with less stigma, treatments, you know, referring them to counselors that are going to be sound like is a good fit for them. So there's so many ways that the athletic trainers / social workers going to interact, you know, on the spot. And then quite frankly, can even follow up beyond that. So if it's a bad day, you know, at practice, or maybe a bad game, we were involved in a national championship game in 2011 that didn't go very well for us. And what I anticipated right away was that social media would be out of control that night because the kids were very frustrated. And so, because of the relationship that I have with them, I may have had, you know, more access to texting them, you know, offline and saying, look, I see what you're saying, but you might not want to say that because, and so, you know, you de-escalate before it even gets out of control by the end of the evening. It's just another avenue, I think, that we have in the setting that we can ourselves where there would not have normally been an athletic trainer to do that.
So when you're dealing with these type of situations and when you're in this type of situation with this student athlete, Jeremy talked about it a little bit with, you know, they are almost free to talk to us a lot of times. And you've all touched on it a little bit when they say, well, I don't know this person, or I don't want to go talk to them. I want to talk to you. That's why I brought it up to you. I understand that you've had possibly something to deal with this. You've played sports. You've been in athletics. You've been in a situation very similar to this, and you're the person that I'm with day to day, and you're the person that I trust. How do you go about that? I guess I know we kind of both touched on it, or you both touched on it, but.
Well, for me, I mean, that's why I'm going back to school, because I think that you really do get into some issues with liability and really just breach of confidentiality. You have to be careful in you know, essentially what chair you're sitting in when you're working with the athletes, because you know the problems don't exist just within the athlete. It's a family system, and so a coach is part of that family system, and if you can't include them, you know, you're really only addressing half of the problem. So it's a group effort. That's the way it works best. Now they may not always want that. And I may entertain, you know, some informal counseling skills that I have with them for a little time, but with the complete intent by the end of, you know, maybe one or two times talking that my goal is to get them comfortable enough so that I can refer them on to, you know, someone who's a specialist because I have another job. When I'm wearing my sneakers, I'm an athletic trainer. You know, I can't really be in three places at once. So that's kind of what I have to do when I've got those kind of scenarios going on. But it's smooth. It sounds kind of choppy the way it goes down, but it's really all in conversation, and it needs to be that way so that they feel like nothing has switched. But you know, having said that, I have too attended, you know, my share of counseling, whether it's been for eating disorders, for depression and suicidality. I respect that. They're not comfortable there. These aren't just people that have never, they're not comfortable with their emotions.
Close to the end here. So, Don, Lucas, why don't y'all kind of run through some of the things here on your slideshow, just as a reminder to be on the lookout. We've kind of touched about it, and then I'm going to ask you for your number one resource for athletic trainers after we run through those. So who's going to start us off?
Sure. Go ahead, Don.
Okay. So some of the things to be on the lookout. Be suspicious of any behavior that is out of the ordinary for your client, anger, anxiety, sadness, or low self-esteem, symptoms that you see in depression, which are, you know, moodiness, feeling sad, anger can be a part of that, not sleeping well or sleeping too much, difficulty eating or eating too much. Also with eating disorders, post-traumatic stress disorder, self-harm or suicidal thoughts. And with that, I also want to say that sometimes when people are depressed, they don't have suicidal thoughts, but they might have thoughts that they want to hurt someone else. Problems with drugs or alcohol, where they're utilizing, you know, pills that aren't prescribed for them, or they're, you know, smoking marijuana, drinking alcohol, and they're doing this as a way to cope with their symptoms. Excessive worry about whether the coach or the parent reaction to their performance or injury.
All right, Lucas.
Yep. And well, when it comes to the athletic training setting, I think we have really hit on it, but making sure that we're aware. But I also wanted to agree with what was already said in terms of the athletic trainer. I think our role is not to be the finisher, but really to be the person that has the beginning thoughts. So we will work with them in the beginning. But then as we are referring, I do think it's important that we're not just throwing them into the wind, but being there as appropriate. And I think that's where getting back to my number one takeaway is having a policy and having the thought about what are we going to do now, instead of waiting until you have a student athlete that comes to you and that you discover that they're having those suicidal thoughts. Be proactive and making sure that this is treated just as seriously as we treat anything else, you know, concussions, heat illnesses, whatever that may be. We have so many other policies in place, but this is absolutely essential because we need to be able to oftentimes be able to do this in a quick, efficient manner.
I could add something just additional to that too, if I have a minute. You know, it's a team is a family unit. So when one person's hurting, it's sometimes like the family affects the rest of the people too. And so fortunately been here, you know, through two suicides, and it's hard enough, I think, to be able to go and work through the issues that were related to the one student athlete. But when you have another 84 people that are directly impacted, you know, in different kind of ways, you're all of a sudden multiplied by 84 in who you're managing. And so as an athletic trainer, it's really what started our mental health program was a suicide. While we, you know, were probably somewhat efficient on the front end of things, we certainly didn't have enough manpower or women power to manage the 84 people, you know, not including the coaching staff that were going to be affected by this. And so someone mentioned planning and policies. I mean, that's kind of all part of that too, is how do you manage the self-care for the people afterwards?
True.
Yeah, we actually just spoke with John Mays recently, and he dealt with sudden cardiac arrest. They ended up reviving the student, but 2 years ago we had a kid die, and that was one of the big things is who's taking care of us, the medical provider, the person taking care of that. And so, yeah, that's interesting that you mentioned that there, because as a social worker, you kind of get all the baggage, but then never have anybody to let go of that. So I guess it's good for the athletic trainer to just go talk to people like Don or you once you get your credentials finished there, Shelley, and just kind of vent as well, I guess, huh?
Well, and it really goes for everything. I mean, when athletic trainers lose a student athlete, they need to debrief about it. For us, when we've had scenarios, they have not been student athletes, but we've had scenarios where we've had, you know, how to do CPR first aid. And in both these cases that I can recall, they were older individuals that just happened to be here. That were not saved, but pulling in, you know, the EMS workers, the athletic trainers that were a part of that, just to debrief, because you have to talk that stuff through. Like, you can pretend that it was okay and that, you know, it was an older person, they've had a great life, but really at the end of the day, someone just died. You know, the way we think is someone just died in my hands and I couldn't save them. So you can't just ignore, you know, those things where, you know, there's no being a tough guy in this, because you do have long-term problems. I mean, PTSD being one of them, when you don't kind of manage that kind of trauma.
All right. Don, I'm going to start with you. Your number one resource thing, somewhere where you're going to point somebody to if they want to find out more.
If you are looking for more information about a potential child abuse, you would want to contact the National Child Abuse Hotline at 1-800-4-A-CHILD, which is 1-800-422-4255.
4453. If you're not sure if that's who you need to be calling, they can help point you in the right direction. And again, as always, I know Mr. Dargo and I, when he was feeling overwhelmed, we would collaborate with one another. And one of the things that I always reminded him is you can't pour from an empty pitcher. So get together with somebody else that you can vent with, like you all were saying earlier, and take time to replenish yourself.
All right, Shelley. Actually, Lucas, we're going to go with you next. Lucas?
Yeah, I just to compliment what Don has already said, I think that really it's full circle in terms of we have to be able to reach out when appropriate, but at the same time, making sure that we feel confident in the decision-making process of actually having those conversations. And I think that having that protocol in place and being able to, just like how we would with spine boarding, we have rehearsing of what, you know, these conversations of different scenarios. I think that being able to do the beginning of what if someone is having a suicidal thought, but I think that Shelley brought up a great point of what if we're dealing with something after the fact and being able to handle it from that way. I think that we need to treat this just as seriously as we've treated anything else, and having those site-specific. So Don mentioned the hotline, but I think that also having the site-specific contact information and phone numbers and email addresses so that the communication can occur quickly and efficiently. Everyone needs to know each other's roles.
All right, Shelley?
He just brings up a great point, too. You know, in our setting here, we're working with the academic center, and a lot of times there's, you know, feelings to the people they feel most comfortable with. And it's not always the athletic trainer. Sometimes it might be their academic counselor. And so here across the street, we may have someone that's kind of in crisis over in the academic center. You know, who do they call? And so there is a lot of collaboration that has to go on in settings like this, so that departments that you don't think would normally be someone you need to include in something are included in the protocols. And I think that's real important. And then it's, you know, it's the coaches, because there's times where the student athlete really trusts one of the coaches on staff, and if the coach has never dealt with trauma or emergency, how are they going to know what to do? So, I mean, the obvious number for me would just be, you know, the National Suicide Hotline, but on a campus like ours, we do have student mental health services. In our athletic department itself, we actually have two full-time people that we work with. We have a counselor, LPC, and we have people we can pretty much, and they're in the training room because we feel this is a medical thing. So we essentially walk them upstairs. And because we've put them in our athletic training room, it's really kind of normalized it. So if there's people walking up and down that hallway, yeah, they're going to see the person they talk to. That's just a normal thing. So having the policies and the protocols, making sure you've reached out to areas that these student athletes interact in, you know, academic center being one of them, I think is also an important thing to think about.
All right. With it being National Athletic Training Month, when this is being recorded, Shelley, I'm going to go with you. Do you have one athletic trainer you would like to thank, give a shout out to, and then we're going to go to you, Lucas?
Oh, let's see. Well, the obvious one, I mean, I can go back to the first athletic trainer I worked with, but really the truth is that my staff here at LSU is a pretty close group of people. We have families, many of us, and as most athletic trainers know, having a life outside of athletic training and being able to have a family, I think, are things that are often difficult, and having any kind of quality of life because we do work so hard. But I think all the athletic trainers at LSU have been in my success, and I think that we all work nicely together. And if I could pass on anything, would be to really work hard on your own staffs to develop that kind of camaraderie and friendship, because you do need each other. And quite frankly, in this conversation, when something happens that's tragic, I'm going to turn to an athletic trainer because they're the ones that are going to understand. And here I happen to have 10 others that are really great people.
All right, very good. Lucas, you are up, sir, an athletic trainer you would like to thank during National Athletic Training Month.
Yeah, well, first off, I guess I want to thank all athletic trainers for all that you do for our student athletes. But I want to reflect and talk a little bit about just my professors at Indiana State right now, because they are the ones that are I'm constantly having these conversations with, and they're just continually making me better and better at what I'm doing. So I appreciate how much time and effort they put into us as individual students and giving us feedback and allowing us to have some collaboration of, ways that we can improve our own clinical practice. And they're not necessarily there with us in the athletic training clinic, but they're there as great communicators and great collaborators. And I just appreciate everything that they do to help me become a better athletic trainer every day.
Thank you, sir. And Don, I know you're not an athletic trainer, but obviously you have interactions with athletic trainers. Is there one that you would like to give a shout out to or say thank you during March?
Well, I think I've gotten to know Lucas Dargo first and foremost, so I'd like to thank him because he's the one that I know. But he opened my eyes to, what is an athletic trainer. So thank you to all of you.
Very good. Lucas, that is the definition of National Athletic Training Month, is sharing the profession with other people. So great job, Lucas. I know this was a couple years ago when you guys kind of began that professional relationship, but great job. Great job sharing what we do and improving what we do as athletic trainers. So I want to thank Nathan Irvin for recommending the podcast on Twitter. I know somebody asked about it, and so they said, hey, check out the Sports Medicine Broadcast. I love listening to that one. So, Nathan, thanks for recommending that there. Keep sharing it with whoever you want. Sean, I want to give you a chance to thank somebody else, an athletic trainer.
I'll add to who I have already said. I would like to thank Leanne Price. She was my director of my program when I was an undergrad at Eastern Illinois University. She did a phenomenal job with running our program and helping guide us, and also being a high school athletic trainer, as well as doing coverage for the University of Illinois club hockey team. And she's kind of one of those athletic trainers that is just like the rest of us, always busy, finding something to do all the time. And she's kind of helped me obviously get to where I'm at by allowing me to get into their program years ago. So,
all right. Thank you, sir. Again, we are recording this during National Athletic Training Month, March. So hopefully you've done some stuff to promote the profession of athletic training. This episode is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/social worker. Again, sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/social worker. On Twitter, I am Mr. Jeremy Jackson, so Mr. Jeremy Jackson. And you can interact with me there, ask me questions. I can get them to Lucas or Don or Shelley. And so check it out. Let me know what you would like to hear about. But again, on Twitter, I'm Mr. Jeremy Jackson. This is sportsmedicinebroadcast.com/social worker. So for Don Tedrow, Lucas Dargo, and Shelley, can you say your last name?
Sure, Mullinex.
Mullinex, okay. I just didn't. I wasn't sure. I knew how I would say it.
It's not French. Yeah. It confuses some people.
All right. So I think when Josh Yellen said, I think he told me Mullinex. But maybe that's just how I remember.
What if Josh Yellen does know nothing?
A California boy, right?
But shout out to Josh Yellen for Athletic Trainer of the Month.
All right. So for everyone here, and of course, my buddy Sean Reedy, that is a wrap. Thanks, guys.